Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Pool by Daphne du Maurier. The children ran out into the lawn. There was space all around them and light and air, with the trees indeterminate beyond. The gardener had cut the grass. The lawn was crisp and firm now because of the hot sun through the day, but near the summer house where the tall grass stood, there were dewdrops like frost clinging to the narrow stems. The children said nothing. The first moment always took them by surprise. The fact that it waited, thought Deborah, all the time they were away, that day after day while they were at school or in the Easter holidays with the aunts at Hunstatten, being blown to bits, or in the Christmas holidays with their father in London, riding on buses and going to theaters. The fact that the garden waited for them was a miracle known only to herself. A year was so long. How did the garden endure the snow clamping down upon it, or the chilly rain that fell in November? Surely sometimes it must mock the slow steps of Grandpapa pacing up and down the terrace in front of the windows, or Grandmama calling to Patch. The garden had to endure month after month of silence while the children were gone. Even the spring and the days of May and June were wasted. All those mornings of butterflies and darting birds, with no one to watch but Patch, gasping for breath on a cool stone slab. So wasted was the garden, so lost. "You must never think we forget," said Deborah in the silent voice she used to her own possessions. "I remember, even at school, in the middle of French." But the ache then was unbearable, that it should be the hard grain of a desk under her hands, and not the grass she bent to touch now. The children had had an argument once about whether there was more grass in the world or more sand, and Roger said that of course there must be more sand, because of under the sea. In every ocean all over the world, there would be sand, if you looked deep down. But there could be grass, too, argued Deborah. A waving grass, a grass that nobody had ever seen. And the color of that ocean grass would be darker than any grass on the surface of the world, in fields or prairies or people's gardens in America. It would be taller than trees, and it would move like corn in a wind. They had run in to ask somebody adult, "What is there most of in the world, grass or sand?" Both children hot and passionate from the argument. But Grandpapa stood there in his old Panama hat, looking for clippers to trim the hedge. He was rummaging in the drawers full of screws, and he said, "What? What?" impatiently. The boy turned red. Perhaps it was a stupid question, but the girl thought, "He doesn't know. They never know." And she made a face at her brother to show that she was on his side. Later they asked their grandmother, and she, being practical, said briskly, "I should think sand. Think of all the grains." And Roger turned in triumph. "I told you so, the grains." Deborah had not considered the grains. The magic of millions and millions of grains clinging together in the world and under the oceans made her sick. Let Roger win. It did not matter. It was better to be in the minority of the waving grass. Now, on this first evening of summer holiday, she knelt and then lay full length on the lawn and stretched her hands out on either side like Jesus on the cross, only face downward, and murmured over and over again the words she had memorized from confirmation preparation. A full, perfect, and sufficient sacrifice. A full, perfect, and sufficient sacrifice. Satisfaction and oblation for the sins of the whole world. To offer herself to the earth, to the garden that had waited patiently all these months since last summer. Surely this must be her first gesture. "Come on," said Roger, rousing himself from his appreciation of how Willis the gardener had mown the grass to just the right closeness for Cricket, and without waiting for his sister's answer, he ran to the summer house and made a dive at the long box in the corner where the stumps were kept. He smiled as he lifted the lid. The familiarity of the smell was satisfying. Old varnish and chip paint, and surely that must be the same spider and the same cobweb. He drew out the stumps one by one and the balls, and there was the ball. It had not been lost after all, as he had feared. It was worn, though a grayish red. He smelt it and bit it to taste the shabby leather. Then he gathered the things in his arms and went out to set up the stumps. "Come and help me measure the pitch," he called to his sister, and looking at her squatting in the grass with her face hidden, his heart sank, because it meant that she was in one of her absent moods and would not concentrate on the cricket. "Deb," he called anxiously, "you are going to play?" Deborah heard his voice through the multitude of earth sounds, the heartbeat and the pulse. If she listened with her ear to the ground, there was a humming much deeper than anything that bees did, or the sea at Hunstanton. The nearest to it was the wind, but the wind was reckless. The humming of the earth was patient. Deborah sat up, and her heart sank, just as her brothers had done, for the same reason, in reverse. The monotony of the game ahead would be like a great chunk torn out of privacy. "How long shall we have to be?" she called. The lack of enthusiasm damped the boy. It was not going to be any fun at all, if she made a favor of it. He must be firm, though. Any concession on his part, she snatched and turned to her advantage. "Half an hour," he said, and then, for encouragement's sake, "you can bat first." Deborah smelt her knees. They had not yet got the country smell, but if she rubbed them in the grass, and in the earth too, the white London look would go. "All right," she said, "but no longer than half an hour." He nodded quickly, and so as not to lose time, and measured out the pitch, and then began ramming the stumps in the ground. Deborah went into the summer house to get the bats. The familiarity of the little wooden hut pleased her, as it had her brother. It was a long time now, many years, since they had played in the summer house, making yet another house inside this one with the help of broken deck chairs. But just as the garden waited for them a whole year, so did the summer house. The windows on either side, cobweb-wrapped and stained, gazing out like eyes. Deborah did her ritual of bowing twice. If she should forget this on her first entrance, it spelt ill luck. She picked out the two bats from the corner, where they were stacked with old croquet hoops, and she knew at once that Roger would choose the one with the rubber handle, even though they could not bat at the same time, and for the whole of the holidays, she must make do with a smaller one. That had half the whipping off. There was a croquet clip lying on the floor. She picked it up and put it on her nose and stood a moment, wondering how it would be if forevermore she had to live thus. Nostrils pinched, making her voice like punch. Would people pity her? "Hurry," shouted Roger, and she threw the clip into the corner, then quickly returned when she was halfway to the pitch, because she knew the clip was lying apart from its fellows, and she might wake in the night and remember it. The clip would turn malevolent and haunt her. She replaced them on the floor with two others, and now she was absolved, and the summer house at peace. "Don't get out too soon," warned Roger, as she stood in the crease he had marked for her. And with a tremendous effort of concentration, Deborah forced her eyes to his retreating figure and watched him roll up his sleeves and pace the required length for his run-up. Down came the ball, and she lunged out, smacking it in the air in easy catch. The impact of ball on bat stung her hands. Roger missed the catch on purpose. Neither of them said anything. "Who shall I be?" asked Deborah. The game could only be endured and concentration kept if Roger gave her a part to play. Not an individual, but a country. "You're India," he said, and Deborah felt herself grow dark and lean. Part of her was tiger. Part of her was sacred cow. The long grass fringing the lawn was jungle, the roof of the summer house a minaret. Even so, the half hour dragged, and when her turn came to bowl, the ball she threw fell wider every time, so that Roger, flushed and self-conscious because their grandfather had come out on the terrace and was watching them, called angrily, "Do try." Once again, the effort at concentration, the figure of their grandfather, a source of apprehension to the boy, for he might criticize them, acting as a spur to his sister. Grandpapa was an Indian god, and tribute must be paid to him, a golden apple. The apple must be flung to slay his enemies. Deborah muttered a prayer, and the ball she bowled came fast and true and hit Roger's off stump. In the moment of delivery, the grandfather had turned away and pottered back again through the French windows of the drawing room. Roger looked around swiftly. His disgrace had not been seen. "Jolly goodbye," he said. "It's your turn to bat again." But his time was up. The stable clock chimed six. Solemnly, Roger drew stumps. "What shall we do now?" he asked. Deborah wanted to be alone, but if she said so on this first evening of the holiday, he would be offended. "Go to the orchard and see how the apples are coming on," she suggested. "Then round by the kitchen garden in case the raspberries haven't all been picked. But you have to do it all without meeting anyone. If you see Willis or anyone, even the cat, you lose a mark." It was the sudden inventions that saved her. She knew her brother would be stimulated at the thought of outwitting the gardener. The aimless wander round the orchard would turn into a stalking exercise. "Will you come too?" he asked. "No," she said. "You have to test your skill." He seemed satisfied with this and ran off towards the orchard, stopping on the way to cut himself a switch from the bamboo. As soon as he had disappeared, Deborah made for the trees fringing the lawn, and once in the shrouded wood, felt herself safe. She walked softly along the alleyway to the pool. The late sunset shafts of light between the trees and onto the alleyway, and admired insects webbed their ways in the beams, ascending and descending like angels on Jacob's ladder. But were there insects, wondered Deborah, or particles of dust, or even split fragments of light itself, beaten out and scattered by the sun? It was very quiet. The woods were made for secrecy. They did not recognize her as the garden did. They did not care that for a whole year she could be at school or at Hunstanton or in London. The woods would never miss her. They had their own dark, passionate life. Deborah came to the opening where the pool lay, with the five alleyways branching from it, and she stood a moment before advancing to the brink, because this was the holy ground and required atonement. She crossed her hands on her breast and shut her eyes. Then she kicked off her shoes. "Mother of all things wild, do with me what you will," she said aloud. The sound of her own voice gave her a slight shock. Then she went down on her knees and touched the ground three times with her forehead. The first part of her atonement was accomplished, but the pool demanded sacrifice, and Deborah had come prepared. There was a stub of pencil she had carried in her pocket throughout the school term, which she called her luck. It had teeth marks on it and a chewed piece of rubber at one end. This treasure must be given to the pool, just as other treasure had been given in the past. A miniature jug, a crested button, a china pig. Deborah felt for the stub of pencil and kissed it. She had carried and caressed it for so many lonely months. Now the moment of parting had come. The pool must not be denied. She flung out her right hand, her eyes still shut, and heard a faint plop as the stub of pencil struck the water. Then she opened her eyes and saw in mid-pool a ripple. The pencil had gone, but the ripple moved, gently shaking the water lilies. The movement symbolized acceptance. Deborah, still on her knees and crossing her hands once more, edged her way to the brink of the pool, and then, crouching there beside it, looked down into the water. Her reflection wavered up at her, and it was not the face she knew, not even the looking-glass face, which anyway was false, but a disturbed image, dark-skinned and ghostly. The crossed hands were like the petals of the water lilies themselves, and the color was not waxen white, but phantom green. The hair, too, was not the live clump she brushed every day and tied back with ribbons, but a canopy, a shroud. When the image smiled, it became more distorted still. Uncrossing her hands, Deborah leant forward, took a twig, and threw a circle three times on the smooth surface. The water shook in ever-widening ripples, and a reflection broken into fragments heaved and danced, a sort of monster, and the eyes were there no longer, nor the mouth. Presently the water became still. Insects, long-legged flies and beetles with spread wings hummed upon it. A dragonfly had all the magnificence of a lily leaf to himself. He hovered there rejoicing. But when Deborah took her eyes off him for a moment, he was gone. At the far end of the pool, beyond the clustering lilies, green scum had formed, and beneath the scum were rooted tangled weeds. They were so thick and had lain in the pool so long that if a man walked into them from the bank, he would be held and choked. A fly, though, or a beetle, could sit upon the surface, and to him the pale green scum would not be treacherous at all, but a resting place, a haven. And if someone threw a stone so that the ripples formed, eventually they came to the scum and rocked it, and the whole of the mossy surface moved in rhythm, a dancing floor for those who played upon it. There was a dead tree standing by the far end of the pool. He could have been fir or pine or even larch, for time had stripped him of identity. He had no distinguishing marks upon his person, but with grotesque limbs straddled the sky. A cap of ivy crowned his naked head. Last winter a dangling branch had broken loose, and this now lay in the pool half submerged, the green scum dripping from the weathered twigs. The soggy branch made a vantage point for birds, and as Deborah watched, a nestling suddenly flew from the undergrowth, enveloping the dead tree, and perched for an instant on the mossy filigree. He was lost in terror. The parent bird cried warningly from some dark safety, and the nestling, prickling to the cry, took off from the branch that had offered him temporary salvation. He swerved across the pool, his flight mistied, yet reached security. The chitter from the undergrowth told of his scolding. When he had gone, silence returned to the pool. It was, so Deborah thought, the time for prayer. The water lilies were folding upon themselves. The ripples ceased, and that dark hollow in the center of the pool, that black stillness where the water was deepest, was surely a funnel to the kingdom that lay below. Down that funnel had traveled the discarded treasures. The stub of pencil had lately plunged to depths. He had now been received as an equal among his fellows. This was the single law of the pool, for there were no other commandments. Once it was over, the first cold had long flight. Deborah knew that the softness of the welcoming water took away all fear. It lapped the face and cleansed the eyes, and the plunge was not into darkness at all, but into light. It did not become blacker as the pool was penetrated, but paler, more golden green, and the mud that people told themselves was there was only a defense against strangers. Those who belonged, who knew, went to the source at once, and there were caverns and fountains and rainbow-colored seas. There were shores of the whitest sand. There was soundless music. Once again, Deborah closed her eyes and bent lower to the pool. Her lips nearly touched the water. This was the great silence, when she had no thoughts and was accepted by the pool. Waves of quiet ringed themselves about her, and slowly she lost all feeling and had no knowledge of her legs, of her kneeling body, or of her cold clasped hands. There was nothing but the intensity of peace. It was a deeper acceptance and listening to the earth, because the earth was of the world. The earth was a throbbing pulse. But the acceptance of the pool meant another kind of hearing, a closing in of the waters. And just as the lilies folded, so did the soul submerge. Deborah? Deborah? Oh no, not now. Don't let them call me back now. It was as though someone had hit her on the back or jumped out at her from behind a corner, the sharp and sudden clamor of another life destroying the silence, the secrecy. And then came the tinkle of the cowbells. It was a signal from their grandmother that the time had come to go in. Not imperious and ugly with authority, like the clanging bell at school summoning those at play to lessons or chapel, but a reminder, nevertheless, that time was all important, that life was ruled to order, that even here, in the holiday home, the children loved, the adult reigned supreme. All right, muttered Deborah, standing up and thrusting her numbed feet into her shoes. This time, the rather raised tone of Deborah and the more hurried clanging of the cowbells, brought long ago from Switzerland, suggested a more imperious grandmama than the tolerant one who seldom questioned. It must mean their supper was already laid. Soup, perhaps getting cold, and the farce of washing hands, of tidying, of combing hair must first be gone through. Come on, Deb. Another shot was close, was right at hand, privacy lost forever. For her brother came running down the alleyway, swishing his bamboo stick in the air. What have you been doing? The question was an intrusion and a threat. She would never have asked him what he had been doing, had he wandered away wanting to be alone. But Roger, alas, did not claim privacy. He liked companionship, and his question now, asked half in irritation, half in resentment, came really from the fear that he might lose her. Nothing, said Deborah. Roger eyed her suspiciously. She was in that mooning mood, and it meant, when they went to bed, that she would not talk. One of the best things in the holiday was having the two adjoining rooms and calling through to Deb, making her talk. Come on, he said. They've rung. And the making of their grandmother into they turned a loved individual into something impersonal, showed Deborah that even if he did not understand, he was on her side. He had been called from play, just as she had. They ran from the woods to the lawn and onto the terrace. Their grandmother had gone inside, but the cowbells hanging by the French windows were still jangling. The custom was for the children to have their supper first at 7, and it was late for them in the dining room on a hot plate. They served themselves. At 7:45, their grandparents had dinner. It was called dinner, but this was a concession to their status. They ate the same as the children. The grandpapa had a savory which was not served to the children. If the children were late for supper, then it put out time, as well as Agnes, who cooked for both generations, and it might mean 5 minutes delay before grandpapa had his soup. This shook routine. The children ran up to the bathroom to wash, then downstairs to the dining room. The grandfather was standing in the hall. Deborah sometimes thought that he would have enjoyed sitting with them while they ate their supper, but he never suggested it. Grandmama had warned them, too, never to be a nuisance, or indeed to shout if Grandpapa was near. This was not because he was nervous, but because he liked to shout himself. "There's going to be a heat wave," he said. He had been listening to the news. "That will mean lunch outside tomorrow," said Roger swiftly. Lunch was the meal they took in common with the grandparents, and it was the moment of the day he disliked. He was nervous that his grandfather would ask him how he was getting on at school. "Not for me, thank you," said Grandpapa. "Too many wasps." Roger was at once relieved. This meant that he and Deborah would have the little round garden table to themselves, but Deborah felt sorry for her grandfather as he went back into the drawing room. Lunch on the terrace could be gay and would liven him up. When people grew old, they had so few treats. "What do you look forward to most in the day?" she once asked her grandmother. "Going to bed," was the reply, "and filling my 2 hot water bottles." Why work through being young, thought Deborah, to this? Back in the dining room, the children discussed what they should do during the heat wave. It would be too hot, Deborah said, for cricket. But they might make a house, suggested Roger, in the trees by the paddock. If he got a few old boards from Willis and nailed them together like a platform and borrowed the orchard ladder, then they could take fruit and bottles of orange squash and keep them up there, and it would be a camp from which they could spy on Willis afterward. Deborah's first instinct was to say she did not want to play, but she checked herself in time. Finding the boards and fixing them would take Roger a whole morning. It would keep him employed. "Yes, it is a good idea," she said, and to foster a spirit of adventure, she looked at his notebook. As they were drinking their soup and approved of items necessary for the camp, while he jotted them down, it was all part of the day-long deceit she practiced to express understanding of his way of life. When they had finished supper, they took their trays to the kitchen and watched Agnes for a moment, as she prepared a second meal for the grandparents. The soup was the same but garnished. Little croutons of toasted bread were added to it, and the butter was made into pats, not cut in a slab. The savory tonight was to be cheese straws. The children finished the ones that Agnes had burnt. Then they went through to the drawing room to say good night. The older people had both changed. Grandmama had a dress that she had worn several years ago in London. She had a cardigan round her shoulders like a cape. "Go carefully with the bath water," she said. "We'll be short if there's no rain." They kissed her smooth, soft skin. It smelt of rose leaves. Grandpapa's chin was sharp and bony. He did not kiss Roger. "Be quiet overhead," whispered their grandmother. The children nodded. The dining room was underneath their rooms, and any jumping about or laughter would make a disturbance. Deborah felt a wave of affection for the two old people. Their lives must be empty and sad. "We are glad to be here," she said. Grandma smiled. This was how she lived, thought Deborah, on little crumbs of comfort. Once out of the room, their spirits soared, and to show relief, Roger chased Deborah upstairs, both laughing for no reason. Undressing, they forgot the instructions about the bath, and when they went into the bathroom, Deborah was to have first go. The water was gurgling into the overflow. They tore out the plug in a panic and listened to the water roaring down the pipe to the drain below. If Agnes did not have the wireless on, she would hear it. The children were too old now for boats or play, but the bathroom was a place for confidence, for sharing of those few tastes they agreed upon, or after quarreling, for moody silence. The one who broke the silence first would then lose face. "Willis has a new bicycle," said Roger. "I saw it propped against the shed. I couldn't try it because he was there, but I shall tomorrow. It's a Raleigh." He liked all practical things. The trying of the gardener's bicycle would give an added interest to the morning of next day. Willis had a big bag of tools in a leather pouch behind the saddle. These would all be felt and the spanner smelling of oil tested for shape and usefulness. "If Willis died," said Deborah, "I wonder what age he would be." It was a kind of remark that Roger resented always. What had death to do with bicycles? "He's 65," he said. "So he'd be 65. "No," said Deborah. "What age when he got there?" Roger did not want to discuss it. "I bet I can ride it around the stables if I lower the seat," he said. "I bet I don't fall off." But if Roger would not rise to death, Deborah would not rise to the wager. "Who cares?" she said. The sudden streak of cruelty stung the brother. Who cares indeed? The horror of an empty world encompassed him, and to give himself confidence, he seized the wet sponge and flung it out of the window. There it splashed on the terrace below. "Grandpapa will step on it and slip," said Deborah, aghast. The image seized them. Choking back laughter, they covered their faces. Hysteria doubled them up. Roger rolled over and over on the bathroom floor. Deborah, the first to recover, wondered why laughter was so near to pain, why Roger's face, twisted now in merriment, was yet the same crumpled thing when his heart was breaking. "Hurry up," she said briefly. "Let's dry the floor." And as they wiped the linoleum with her towels, the action sobered them both. Back in their bedrooms, the door open between them, they watched the light slowly fading, but the air was warm like day. Their grandfather and the people who said that the weather was going to be were right. The heat wave was on its way. Deborah, leaning out of the open window, fancied she could see it in the sky, a dull haze where the sun had been before, and the trees beyond the lawn, they colored when they were having their supper in the dining room, had turned into night birds with outstretched wings. The garden knew about the promised heat wave and rejoiced. The lack of rain was of no consequence yet, for the warm air was a trap, lulling it into a drowsy contentment. The dull murmur of their grandparents' voices came from the dining room below. What did they discuss, wondered Deborah? Did they make those sounds to reassure the children, or were their voices part of their unreal world? Presently the voices ceased, and then there was a scraping of chairs and voices from a different quarter, the drawing room now, and a faint smell of their grandfather's cigarette. Deborah called softly to her brother, but he did not answer. She went through to his room, and he was asleep. He must have fallen asleep suddenly in the midst of talking. She was relieved. Now she could be alone again, not have to keep up the pretense of sharing conversation. Dusk was everywhere, the sky a deepening black. "When they've gone up to bed," thought Deborah, "then I'll be truly alone." She knew what she was going to do. She waited there by the open window, and the deepening sky lost the veil that covered it. The haze disintegrated, and the stars broke through. Where there had been nothing was life, dusty and bright, and the waiting earth gave off a scent of knowledge. Dew rose from the pores. The lawn was white. Patch, the old dog, who slept at the end of Grandpapa's bed on a plaid rug, came out onto the terrace and barked hoarsely. Deborah leant out and threw a piece of creeper onto him. He shook his back. Then he waddled slowly to the flower tub above the steps and cocked his leg. It was his nightly routine. He barked once more, staring blindly at the hostile trees, and went back into the drawing room. Soon afterwards, someone came to close the windows. Grandmama thought Deborah, for the touch was light. There is shedding out the best, said the child to herself. All the meaning and all the point. Patch, being an animal, should know better. He ought to be in a kennel where he could watch. But instead, grown fat and soft, he preferred the bumpiness of her grandfather's bed. He had forgotten the secrets. So had they, the old people. Deborah heard her grandparents come upstairs. First her grandmother, the quicker of the two, and then her grandfather. More labored, saying a word or two to Patch as a little dog wheezed his way up. There was a general clicking of lights and shutting of doors. Then silence. How remote the world of the grandparents, undressing with curtains closed, a pattern of life unchanged for so many years. What went on without would never be known. He that has ears to hear, let him hear, said Deborah. And she thought of the callousness of Jesus, which no priest could explain. Let the dead bury their dead. All the people in the world undressing now, or sleeping, not just in the village, but in cities and capitals. They were shedding out the truth. They were burying their dead. They wasted silence. The stable clock struck 11. Deborah pulled on her clothes, not the cotton frock of the day, but her old jeans that Grandmama disliked, rolled up above her knees, and a jersey, sand shoes with a hole that did not matter. She was cunning enough to go down by the back stairs. Patch would bark if she tried the front stairs close to the grandparents' room. The back stairs led past Agnes' room, which smelt of apples, though she never ate fruit. Deborah could hear her snoring. She would not even wake on Judgment Day. And this led her to wonder on the truth of that fable, too, for there might be so many millions by then who liked their graves. Grandpapa, for instance, fond of his routine and irritated at the sudden riot of trumpets. Deborah crept past the pantry in the servants' hall. It was only a tiny sitting room for Agnes, but long usage had given it the dignity of the name, and unlatched and unbolted the heavy back door. Then she stepped outside onto the gravel and took the long way round by the front of the house so as not to tread on the terrace fronting the lawns and the gardens. The warm night air claimed her. In a moment it was part of her. She walked on the grass and her shoes were instantly soaked. She flung up her arms to the sky. Power ran to her fingertips. Excitement was communicated from the waiting tree and the orchard and the paddock. The intensity of their secret life caught at her and made her run. It was like nothing but the excitement of ordinary looking forward, of birthday presents, of Christmas stockings, but the pull of a magnet. Her grandfather had shown her once how it worked, little needles springing to the jaws, and now night and the sky above were a vast magnet, and the things that waited below were needles, caught up in the great demand. Deborah went to the summer house, and it was not sleeping like the house fronting the terrace, but open to understanding, sharing complicity. Even the dusty windows caught the light, and the cobwebs shone. She rummaged for the old lilo and the moth-eaten car rug that Grandmama had thrown out 2 summers ago, and bearing them over her shoulder, she made her way to the pool. The alleyway was ghostly, and Deborah knew, for all her mounting tension, that the test was hard. Part of her was still body-bound and afraid of shadows. If anything stirred, she would jump and know true terror. She must show defiance, though. The woods expected it. Like old, wise llamas, they expected courage. She sensed approval as she ran the gauntlet, the tall trees watching. Any sign of turning back, of panic, and they would crowd upon her in a choking mass, smothering protests. Branches would become arms, gnarled and knotty, ready to strangle, and the leaves of the higher trees fold in and close like the sudden furling of giant umbrellas. The smaller undergrowth, obedient to the will, would become a briary of a million thorns, where animals of no known world crouch, snarling, their eyes on fire. To show fear was to show misunderstanding. The woods were merciless. Deborah walked the alleyway to the pool, her left hand holding the lilo and the rug on her shoulder, her right hand raised in salutation. This was a gesture of respect. Then she paused before the pool and laid down her burden beside it. The lilo was to be her bed, the rug her cover. She took off her shoes, also in respect, and lay down upon the lilo. Then, drawing the rug to her chin, she lay flat, her eyes upon the sky. The gauntlet of the alleyway over, she had no more fear. The woods had accepted her, and the pool was the final resting place, the doorway, the key. I shan't sleep, thought Deborah. I shall just lie awake here all the night and wait for morning. But it will be a kind of introduction to life, like being confirmed. The stars were thicker now than they had been before. No space in the sky without a prick of light, each star a sun. Some, she thought, were newly born, white hot, and others wise and colder, nearing completion. The law encompassed them, fixing the riotous path, but how they fell and tumbled depended upon themselves. Such peace, such stillness, such sudden quietude, excitement gone. The trees were no longer menacing, but guardians, and the pool was primeval water, the first, the last. Then Deborah stood at the wicket gate, the boundary, and there was a woman with outstretched hand, demanding tickets. Pass through, she said, when Deborah reached her. We saw you coming. The wicket gate became a turnstile. Deborah pushed against it, and there was no resistance. She was through. What is it, she asked. Am I really here at last? Is this the bottom of the pool? It could be, smiled the woman. There are so many ways, you just happened to choose this one. Other people were pressing to come through. They had no faces. They were only shadows. Deborah stood aside to let them by, and in a moment, they had all gone, all phantoms. Why only now, tonight? Asked Deborah. Why not in the afternoon, when I came to the pool? It's a trick, said the woman. You seize on the moment in time. We were here this afternoon. We're always here. Our life goes on around you, but nobody knows it. The trick's easier by night, that's all. Am I dreaming then? Asked Deborah. No, said the woman. This isn't a dream. And it isn't death either. It's the secret world. The secret world. It was something Deborah had always known. And now the pattern was complete. The memory of it and the relief were so tremendous that something seemed to burst inside her heart. Of course, she said, of course. And everything that had ever been fell into place. There was no disharmony. The joy was indescribable. And the surge of feeling like wings about her in the air lifted her away from the turnstile and the woman, and she had all knowledge. That was it, the invasion of knowledge. I'm not myself then after all, she thought. I knew I wasn't. It was only the task given. And looking down, she saw a little child who was blind trying to find her way. Pity seized her. She bent down and put her hands on the child's eyes, and they opened. And the child was herself at 2 years old. The incident came back. It was when her mother died and Roger was born. It doesn't matter after all, she told the child. You are not lost. You don't have to go on crying. Then the child that had been herself melted and became absorbed in the water and the sky, and the joy of the invading flood intensified so that there was no body at all, but only being, no words, only movements, and the beating of wings, this above all, the beating of wings. Don't let me go. It was a pulse in her ear and a cry, and she saw the woman at the turnstile put up her hands to hold her. Then there was such darkness, such dragging, terrible darkness, and the beginning of pain all over again. The leaden heart, the tears, the misunderstanding. The voice saying, no, was her own harsh, worldly voice. And she was staring at the restless trees, black and ominous against the sky. One hand trailed in the water of the pool. Deborah sat up sobbing. The hand that had been in the pool was wet and cold. She dried it on the rug, and suddenly she was seized with such fear that her body took possession, and throwing aside the rug, she began to run along the alleyway, the dark trees mocking, and the welcome of the woman at the turnstile turned to treachery. Safety lay in the house behind the closed curtains. Security was with the grandparents sleeping in their beds, and like a leaf driven before a whirlwind, Deborah was out of the woods and across the silver soaking lawn, up the steps beyond the terrace, and through the garden gate to the back door. The slumbering solid house received her. It was like an old staid person who, surviving many trials, had learnt experience. Don't take any notice of them, it seemed to say, jerking its head. Did a house have a head towards the woods beyond? They've made no contribution to civilization. I'm man-made and different. This is where you belong, dear child. Now settle down. Deborah went back again upstairs and into her bedroom.
Nothing had changed. It was still the same. Going to the open window, she saw that the woods and the lawn seemed unaltered from the moment. How long back she did not know, when she had stood there deciding upon the visit to the pool. The only difference now was in herself. The excitement had gone, the tension too. Even the terror of those last moments, when her flying feet had brought her to the house, seemed unreal. She drew the curtains, just as her grandmother might have done, and climbed into bed. Her mind was not preoccupied with practical difficulties, like explaining the presence of the Lilo in the rug beside the pool. Willis might find them and tell her grandfather. The feel of her own pillow and of her own blankets reassured her. Both were familiar, and being tired was familiar too. It was a solid bodily ache, like the tiredness after too much jumping or cricket. The thing was, though, in the last remaining conscious thread of thought decided to postpone conclusion until the morning, which was real. The safety of the house or the secret world. When Deborah woke next morning, she knew at once that her mood was bad. It would last her for the day. Her eyes ached and her neck was stiff, and there was a taste in her mouth like magnesia. Immediately Roger came running into her room, his face refreshed and smiling from some dreamless sleep, and jumped on her bed. "It's come," he said. "The heat wave's come. It's going to be 90 in the shade." Deborah considered how best she could damp his day. "It can go to 100 for all I care," she said. "I'm going to read all morning." His face fell. A look of bewilderment came into his eyes. "But the house?" he said. "We decided to have a house in the trees. Don't you remember? I was going to get some planks from Willis." Deborah turned over in bed and humped her knees. "You can if you like," she said. "I think it's a silly game." She shut her eyes, feigning sleep, and presently she heard his feet patter slowly back to his own room, and then the thud of a ball against the wall. "If he goes on doing that," she thought maliciously, "Grandpapa will ring his bell, and Agnes will come panting up the stairs." She hoped for destruction, for grumbling and snapping, and everyone falling out, not speaking. That was the way of the world. The kitchen where the children breakfasted faced west, so it did not get the morning sun. Agnes had hung up fly papers to catch wasps. The cereal puffed wheat was soggy. Deborah complained, mashing the mess with her spoon. "It's a new packet," said Agnes. "You're mighty particular all of a sudden." "Deb's got out of bed the wrong side," said Roger. The two remarks fused to make a challenge. Deborah seized the nearest weapon, a knife, and threw it at her brother. It narrowly missed his eye, but cut his cheek. Surprised, he put his hand to his face and felt the blood. Hurt not by the knife, but by his sister's action, his face turned red and his lower lip quivered. Deborah ran out of the kitchen and slammed the door. Her own violence distressed her, but the power of the mood was too strong. Going on to the terrace, she saw that the worst had happened. Willis had found the Lilo in the rug and put them to dry in the sun. He was talking to her grandmother. Deborah tried to slip back into the house, but it was too late. "Deborah, how very thoughtless of you," said Grandmama. "I tell you children every summer that I don't mind you taking the things from the hut into the garden, if only you'll put them back." Deborah knew she should apologize, but the mood forbade it. "That old rug is full of moth," she said contemptuously, "and the Lilas are rainproof back. It doesn't hurt them." They both stared at her, and her grandmother flushed, just as Roger had done when she had thrown the knife at him. Then her grandmother turned her back and continued giving some instructions to the gardener. Deborah stalked along the terrace, pretending that nothing had happened, and skirting the lawn, she made her way towards the orchard, and so to the fields beyond. She picked up a windfall, but as soon as her teeth bit into it, the taste was green. She threw it away. She went and sat on a gate and stared in front of her, looking at nothing. Such deception everywhere. Such sour sadness. It was like Adam and Eve being locked out of paradise. The Garden of Eden was no more. Somewhere, very close, the woman at the turnstile waited to let her in. The secret world was all about her, but the key was gone. Why had she ever come back? What had brought her? People were going about their business. The old man who came 3 days a week to help Willis was sharpening a scythe behind the tool shed. Beyond the field, where the lane ran towards the main road, she could see the top of the postman's head. He was pedaling his bicycle towards the village. She heard Roger calling, "Deb! Deb!" which meant that he had forgiven her, but still the mood held sway, and she did not answer. Her own dullness made her own punishment. Presently a knocking sound told her that he had got the planks from Willis and embarked on the building of his house. He was like his grandfather. He kept to the routine set for himself. Deborah was consumed with pity, not for the sullen self humped upon the gate, but for all of them going about their business in the world who did not hold the key. The key was hers. She had lost it. Perhaps if she worked her way through the long day, the magic would return with the evening, and she would find it once again. Or even now by the pool, there might be a clue, a vision. Deborah slid off the gate and went the long way round. By skirting the fields, parched under the sun, she could reach the other side of the wood and meet no one. The husky wheat was stiff. She had to keep close to the hedge to avoid brushing it, and the hedge was tangled. Foxgloves had grown too tall and were bending with empty sockets, their flowers gone. There were nettles everywhere. There was no gate into the wood, and she had to climb the pricking hedge with a barbed wire tearing her knickers. Once in the wood, some measure of peace returned, but the alleyways this side had not been scythed, and the grass was long. She had to wade through it like a sea, brushing it aside with her hands. She came upon the pool from behind the monster tree, the hybrid whose naked arms were like a dead man's stumps projecting at all angles. This side, on the lip of the pool, the scum was carpet thick, and all the lilies, coaxed by the risen sun, had opened wide. They basked as lizards bask on hot stone walls. But here, with stems in water, they swung in grace, cluster upon cluster, pink and waxen white. They're asleep, thought Deborah. So is the wood. The morning is not their time, and it seemed to her beyond possibility that the turnstile was at hand, and the woman waiting, smiling. She said they were always there, even in the day, but the truth is that being a child, I'm blinded in the day. I don't know how to see. She dipped her hands in the pool, and the water was tepid brown. She tasted her fingers, and the taste was rank. Brackish water, stagnant from long stillness. Yet beneath she knew, by night the woman waited. And not only the woman, but the whole secret world. Deborah began to pray. Let it happen again, she whispered. Let it happen again tonight. I won't be afraid. The sluggish pool made no acknowledgement, but the very silence seemed a testimony of faith, of acceptance. Beside the pool, where the imprint of the lilac had marked the moss, Deborah found a Kirby grip fallen from her hair during the night. It was proof of visitation. She threw it into the pool as part of the treasury. Then she walked back into the ordinary day and the heat wave, and her black mood was softened. She went to find Roger in the orchard. He was busy with the platform. Three of the boards were fixed, and the noisy hammering was something that had to be borne. He saw her coming in as always after trouble, sensed that her mood had changed, and mention must never be made of it. Had he called, feeling better, it would have revived the antagonism, and she might not play with him all the day. Instead, he took no notice. She must be the first to speak. Deborah waited at the foot of the tree, then bent and handed him up an apple. It was green, but the offering meant peace. He ate it manfully. Thanks, he said. She climbed into the tree beside him and reached for the box of nails. Contact had been renewed. All was well between them. The hot day spun itself out like a web. The heat wave stretched across the sky, dun-colored and opaque. Crouching on the burning boards of the apple tree, the children drank ginger beer and fanned themselves with dock leaves. They grew hotter still. When the cowbell summoned them for lunch, they found that their grandmother had drawn the curtains of all the rooms downstairs, and the drawing room was a vault and strangely cool. They flung themselves into chairs. No one was hungry. Patch lay under the piano, his soft mouth dripping saliva. Grandmama had changed into sleeveless linen dress, never before seen. And Grandpapa, and a dented Panama carried a fly whisk used years ago in Egypt. 91, he said grimly, on the Air Ministry roof. It was on the 1 o'clock news. Deborah thought of the men who must measure heat, toiling up and down on this ministry roof with rods and tapes and odd-shaped instruments. Did anyone care about Grandpapa? Can we take our lunch outside? Asked Roger. His grandmother nodded. Speech was too much effort, and she sank languidly into her chair at the foot of the dining room table. The roses she had picked last night had wilted. The children carried chicken drumsticks to the summer house. It was too hot to sit inside, but they sprawled in the shadow it cast, their heads on faded cushions shedding kapok. Somewhere far above their heads, an aeroplane climbed like a small silver fish and was lost in space. "A meteor," said Roger. "Grandpapa says they're obsolete." Deborah thought of Icarus soaring towards the sun. Did he know when his wings began to melt? How did he feel? She stretched out her arms and thought of them as wings. The fingertips were the first to curl and then turn cloggy, soft, and useless, with terror in the sudden loss of height, the drooping power. Roger watched her. Hoped it was some game. He threw his picked drumstick into a flower bed and jumped to his feet. "Look," he said, "I'm a javelin." And he too stretched his arms and ran in circles, banking. Jet noises came from his clenched teeth. Deborah dropped her arms and looked at the drumstick. What had been clean and white from Roger's teeth was now earth-brown. Was it offended to be chucked away? Years later, when everyone was dead, it would be found, molded like a fossil. Nobody would care. "Come on," said Roger. "Where to?" she asked. "To fetch the raspberry," he said. "You go," she told him. Roger did not like going into the dining room alone. He was self-conscious. Deborah made a shield from the adult eyes. In the end, he consented to fetch her raspberries without her on condition that she played cricket after tea. After tea was a long way off. She watched him return, walking very slowly, bearing the plates of raspberries and clotted cream. She was seized with sudden pity, that same pity which earlier she had felt for all people other than herself. How absorbed he was, how intent on the moment that held him. But tomorrow he would be some old man far away, the garden forgotten, and this day long past. "Grandmama says it can't go on," he announced. "There'll have to be a storm." "But why? Why not forever? Why not breathe a spell so that all of them could stay locked and dreaming, like the courtiers and the Sleeping Beauty, never knowing, never waking, cobwebs in their hair and on their hands, tendrils imprisoning the house itself. "Race me," said Roger, and to please him, she lunged her spoon into the mush of raspberry, but finished last to his delight. No one moved during the long afternoon. Grandmama went upstairs to her room. The children saw her at her window in her petticoat, drawing the curtains closed. Grandpapa put his feet up in the drawing room, a handkerchief over his face. Patch did not stir from his place under the piano. Roger, undefeated, found employment still. He first helped Agnes to shell peas for supper, squatting on the back doorstep while she relaxed on a lopsided basket chair dragged from the servants' hall. This task finished, he discovered a tin bath put away in the cellar in which Patch had been washed in younger days. He carried it to the lawn and filled it with water. Then he stripped to bathing trunks and sat in it solemnly, an umbrella over his head to keep off the sun. Deborah lay on her back behind the summer house, wondering what would happen if Jesus and Buddha met. Would there be discussion, courtesy, an exchange of views like politicians at summit talks? Or were they, after all, the same person, born at separate times? The queer thing was that this topic, interesting now, meant nothing in the secret world. Last night, through the turnstile, all problems disappeared. They were non-existent. There was only the knowledge and the joy. She must have slept because when she opened her eyes, she saw, to her dismay, that Roger was no longer in the bath, but was hammering the cricket stumps into the lawn. It was 4:45. "Hurry up," he called when he saw her move. "I've had tea." She got up and dragged herself into the house, sleepy still and giddy. The grandparents were in the drawing room, refreshed from the long repose of the afternoon. Grandpapa smelt of eau de cologne. Even Patch had come to and was lapping his saucer of cold tea. "You look tired," said Grandmama critically. "Are you feeling all right?" Deborah was not sure. Her head was heavy. It must have been sleeping in the afternoon, a thing she never did. "I think so," she answered, "but if anyone gave me roast pork, I know I'd be sick." "No one suggested you should eat roast pork," said her grandmother, surprised. "Have a cucumber sandwich, they're cool enough." Grandpapa was lying in wait for a wasp. He watched it hover over his tea, grim, expectant. Suddenly he slammed at the air with his whisk. "Got the brute," he said in triumph. He grounded into the carpet with his heel. It made Deborah think of Jehovah. "Don't rush around the heat," said Grandmama. "It isn't wise. Can't you and Roger play some nice quiet game?" "What sort of game?" asked Deborah. but her grandmother was without invention. The croquet mallets were all broken. "We might pretend to be dwarfs and use the head," said Deborah, and she toyed for a moment with the idea of squatting to croquet. Their knees would stiffen, though. It would be too difficult. "I'll read aloud to you if you like," said Grandmama. Deborah seized upon the suggestion. It delayed cricket. She ran out onto the lawn and patted the idea to make it acceptable to Roger. "I'll play afterward," she said, "and that ice cream that Agnes has in the fridge. You can eat all of it. I'll talk tonight in bed." Roger hesitated. Everything must be weighed. Three goods to balance evil. "You know that stick of sealing wax that Daddy gave you?" he said. "Yes. Can I have it?" The balance for Deborah, too. The quiet of the moment in opposition to the loss of the long, thick stick so brightly red. "All right," she grudged. Roger left the cricket stumps and they went into the drawing room. Grandpapa, at the first suggestion of reading aloud, had disappeared, taking Patch with him. Grandmama had cleared away the tea. She found her spectacles in the book. It was Black Beauty. Grandmama kept no modern children's book, and this made common ground for the three of them. She read the terrible chapter where the stable lad lets Beauty get overheated and gives him a cold drink and does not put on his blanket. The story was suited to the day. Even Roger listened entranced, and Deborah, watching her grandmother's calm face and hearing her careful voice reading the sentences, thought how strange it was that Grandmama could turn herself into Beauty with such ease. She was a horse, suffering there with pneumonia in the stable, being saved by the wise coachman. After the reading, cricket was an anticlimax, but Deborah must keep her bargain. She kept thinking of Black Beauty writing the book. It showed how good the story was. Grandmama said because no child had ever yet questioned the practical side of it or posed a picture of a horse with a pen in its hoof. A modern horse would have a typewriter, thought Deborah, and she began to bow to Roger, smiling to herself as she did so because of the 20th century Beauty clacking with both hooves at a machine. This evening, because of the heat wave, the routine was changed. They had their baths first before their supper, for they were hot and exhausted from the cricket. Then, putting on pajamas and cardigans, they ate their supper on the terrace, for once Grandmama was indulgent. It was still so hot that they could not take chill, and the dew had not yet risen. It made it a small excitement being in pajamas on the terrace. "Like people abroad," said Roger, "or natives in the South Seas," said Deborah, "or beachcombers who had lost caste." Grandpapa changed into a white tropical jacket, had not lost caste. "He's a white trader," whispered Deborah. "He's made a fortune out of pearls." Roger choked. Any joke about his grandfather, whom he feared, had all the sweet agony of danger. "What's the thermometer say?" asked Deborah. Her grandfather, pleased at her interest, went to inspect it. "Still above 80, he said with relish. Deborah, when she cleaned her teeth later, thought how pale her face looked in the mirror above the wash basin. It was not brown, like Roger's, from the day in the sun, but wan and yellow. She tied back her hair with a ribbon, and the nose and chin were peaky sharp. She yawned largely, as Agnes did in the kitchen on Sunday afternoons. "Don't forget, you promised to talk," said Roger quickly. Talk. That was the burden. She was so tired, she longed for the white smoothness of her pillow, all blankets thrown aside, bearing only a single sheet, but Roger, wakeful on his bed, the door between them wide, would not relent. Laughter was the one solution. And to make him hysterical, and so exhaust him sooner, she fabricated a day in the life of Willis, from his first morning kipper to his final glass of beer at the village. The adventures in between would have tried Gulliver. Roger's delight drew protest from the adult world below. There was a sound of a bell, and then Agnes came up the stairs and put her head round the corner of Deborah's door. "Your granny says you're not to make so much noise," she said. Deborah, spent with invention, lay back and closed her eyes. She could go no further. The children called good night to each other, both speaking at the same time, from age-long custom, beginning with their names and addresses, and ending with the world, the universe, and space. Then the final main, good night, after which neither must ever speak on pain of unknown calamity. "I must try and keep awake," thought Deborah, but the power was not in her. Sleep was too compelling, and it was hours later that she opened her eyes and saw the curtains blowing and the forked flash light the ceiling and heard the trees tossing and sobbing against the sky. She was out of bed in an instant. Chaos had come. There were no stars, and the night was sulphurous. A great crack split the heavens and tore them in two. The garden groaned. If the rain would only fall, there might be mercy. And the trees, imploring, bowed themselves this way and that, while the vivid lawn, bright in expectation, lay like a sheet of metal exposed to flame. Let the waters break. Bring down the rain. Suddenly the lightning forked again, and standing there, alive yet immobile, was the woman by the turnstile. She stared up at the windows of the house, and Deborah recognized her. The turnstile was there, inviting entry, and already the phantom figures passed through it, crowded towards the trees beyond the lawn. The secret world was waiting. Through the long day, while the storm was brewing, it had hovered there, unseen beyond her reach, but now the night had come, and the thunder with it, the barriers were down. Another crack, mighty in its summons, the turnstile yawned, and the woman with her hand upon it smiled and beckoned. Deborah ran out of the room and down the stairs. Somewhere somebody called. Roger, perhaps, it did not matter. And Patch was barking. But caring nothing for concealment, she went through the dark drawing room, opened the French window onto the terrace. The lightning searched the terrace and lit the paving, and Deborah ran down the steps onto the lawn, where the turnstile gleamed. Haste was imperative. If she did not run, the turnstile might be closed. The woman vanished, and all the wonder of the sacred world be taken from her. She was in time. The woman was still waiting. She held out her hand for the tickets, but Deborah shook her head. I have none. The woman, laughing, brushed her through into the secret world, where there were no laws, no rules, and all the faceless phantoms ran before her to the woods, blown by the rising wind. Then the rain came. The sky, deep brown, as the lightning pierced it, opened, and the water hissed to the ground, rebounding from the earth in bubbles. There was no order now in the alleyway. The ferns had turned to trees, the trees to titans. All moved in ecstasy with sweeping limbs, but the rhythm was broken up, tumultuous, so that some of them were bent backwards, torn by the sky, and others dashed their heads to the undergrowth, where they were caught and beaten. In the world behind, laughed Deborah as she ran. This would be punishment, but here in the secret world, it was a tribute. The phantoms who ran beside her were like waves. They were linked one with another, and they were each one of them. And Deborah took part of the night force that made the sobbing and the laughter. The lightning forked where they willed it, and the thunder cracked as they looked upwards to the sky. The pool had come alive. The water lilies had turned to hands with palms upraised, and in the far corner, usually so still under the green scum, bubbles sucked at the surface, streaming and multiplying as the torrents fell. Everyone crowded to the pool. The phantoms bowed and crouched by the water's edge, and now the woman had set up her turnstile in the middle of the pool, beckoning them once more. Some remnant of a sense of social order rose in Deborah and protested. "But we've already paid," she shouted, and remembered a second later that she had passed through free. Must there be duplication? Was a secret world a rainbow always repeating itself, alighting on another hill when you believed yourself beneath? No time to think. The phantoms had gone through. The lightning, streaky white, lit the old dead monster tree with his crown of ivy, and because he had no spring now in his joints, he could not sway in tribute with the trees and ferns, but had to remain there rigid like a crucifix. "And now? And now? And now?" called Deborah. The triumph was that she was not afraid, was filled with such wild acceptance. She ran into the pool. Her living feet felt the mud and the broken sticks and all the tangle of old weeds, and the water was up to her armpits and her chin. The lilies held her. The rain blinded her. The woman and the turnstile were no more. "Take me too," cried the child. "Don't leave me behind." In her heart was a savage disenchantment. They had broken their promise. They had left her in the world. The pool that claimed her now was not the pool of secrecy, but dank, dark, brackish water choked with scum. "Grandpapa says he's going to have it fenced round," said Roger. "It should have been done years ago. A proper fence, then nothing can ever happen. But barrel loads of shingle tipped in it first. Then it won't be a pool, but just a DuPont. DuPonts aren't dangerous." He was looking at her over the edge of her bed. He had risen in status, being the only one of them downstairs, the bearer of tidings, good or ill. The go-between, Deborah, had been ordered 2 days in bed. "I should think by Wednesday," he went on, "you'd be able to play cricket. It's not as if you're hurt. People who walk in their sleep are just a bit potty." "I did not walk in my sleep," said Deborah. "Grandpapa said you must have done," said Roger. "It was a good thing that Patch woke him up, and he saw you going across the lawn." Then, to show his release from tension, he stood on his hands. Deborah could see the sky from her bed. It was flat and dull. The day was a summer day that had worked through storm. Agnes came into the room with junket on a tray. She looked important. "Now run off," she said to Roger. "Deborah doesn't want to talk to you. She's supposed to rest." Surprisingly, Roger obeyed, and Agnes placed the junket on the table beside the bed. "You don't feel hungry, I expect," she said. "Never mind. You can eat this later when you fancy. Have you got a pain?" "It's usual, the first time." "No," said Deborah. What had happened to her was personal. They had prepared her for it at school, but nevertheless, it was a shock not to be discussed with Agnes. The woman hovered a moment in case the child asked questions, but seeing that none came, she turned and left the room. Deborah, her cheek on her hand, stared at the empty sky. The heaviness of knowledge lay upon her, a strange, deep sorrow. "It won't come back," she thought. "I've lost the key." The hidden world, like ripples on the pool, so soon to be filled in and fenced, was out of her reach forever.